Caskey hits this one deep to left field. This has a chance. This ball is gone. It's a walk-off home run.
Now Caleb driving left side. Alley-oop to Nelson. Throws it down with two hands.
Raiders make the handoff. Keeps it running left. He's across midfield. 40, 30, 20, 10. Jalen Reiner to the house.
Welcome to the Second to None podcast. The A-State Podcast, presented by First National Bank and Cavanaugh Auto Group. Now, here's Matt Stoltz and Brad Bobo.
Coming up, the basketball teams back at home. Tennis with a busy weekend. Indoor track and field was competing in Nashville this past weekend. But we're going to spend a lot of time today talking football. And there's nobody better to do that with than with our good friend, the head coach of the Red Wolves, Butch Jones. How you doing, Coach?
I'm doing great. Happy New Year. It's kind of mid-January, but still the new year, so happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, and happy birthday. Full disclosure here, we're recording this on Friday for a Tuesday podcast release, but I thought it was really cool that you came in here on your birthday.
No other place I'd rather spend my birthday than right. with you and Bobo. So I appreciate that. Actually, on the way in, you know, our goal today is we're going to rival New Heights. So I told Travis we're coming after him with the Second to None podcast, and we're going after him.
I love it.
Hey, what was it like as a kid having a birthday within 3 weeks of Christmas? Did you feel shortchanged?
No, not really. You know, you just got more presents at that point in time. But, you know, what's funny is you go through, like, I was, like, driving in today, and I was trying to go through decades. You know, like, your 10th birthday, your 20th, your 30th, your 40th. Where were yeah. you? What did you do? And, you know, the one birthday that kind of sticks out for some reason was my 16th birthday. And I still remember being back home, and we had a basketball game. It was on a Tuesday night, and I was a sophomore playing on varsity and had two game-winning free throws at the end of the game. And I remember the team and my mom throwing a birthday celebration on a Tuesday night. And for some reason, you know, I know it's not that decade, but that's kind of the one that I always go back to for some odd reason and remember that.
What a great birthday.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah.
You hit the shots.
It's something that you never forget. I wouldn't want to push redo and do it all over again.
We haven't really sat down and discussed the bowl game yet.
It's been a long journey.
Let's go ahead and talk about that first, because what a great way to finish off a really nice season. You win 8 games, but to face a team like that and to win the way you did in that game, I thought such a great way to cap off the season. And that was a really good team that you beat. I mean, Bowling Green, we talked about it going in, lost by a touchdown to Penn State. We saw just how good they were. Lost by a touchdown to Texas A&M. And you led wire to wire in that game. And as far as a complete football game, that was pretty much everything you could hope for, I would think.
You just said it. Complete football game against a quality opponent. I think, you know, from a talent standpoint, that was probably the best group of five football team we had faced all year. And we played our best football at the end. And I think it's, you know, if you go back with the journey, 2 wins, 3 wins, 6 wins, 8 wins, you know, those first couple years, it was miserable. We were focusing on the process, but we always spoke about learning how to win. And there's a process that goes behind learning how to win. Our football program, our football team knew how to win, and they expected to win. And I think, you know, we've said it. I don't know if people truly value at this level what 8 wins means. And if you just do a fact check, it's tied for the 4th best season in the history of Arkansas State football since joining the Sun Belt in terms of win total with 8 wins. Having a bowl game, 1.7 million followers. I believe it's the most watched Sun Belt bowl game, and really one of the tops in all of the bowl season with that viewership and what it meant to our football program. So learning how to win. Winning is very difficult, but I think in the manner with which we prepared to, you know, we had a great week, 10 days of preparation back here in Jonesboro. We even practiced one night in the stadium to kind of mimic game time at 8 p.m. It was cold. It was miserable. Our players bought in that was going to be a competitive edge, a competitive advantage for them. Then You know, we spoke about what did we learn from the previous trip when we played in the bowl game the year before, and you're a byproduct of your experiences. And then it's not so much what you do when you get there at the bowl site that you'll remember, but you'll always remember the game and what it would mean to be a bowl champion and all the things that it would take to win the game. I thought our focus, I thought our preparation was outstanding. I still remember the night before the game, the players being locked in. You know, we challenged them. We told them a number of things. We told them that we needed to score or set up a score on a punt return. Check. We were able to do that. We told them that the game would probably come down to the hands team. I spent 30 minutes the night before the game reviewing the hands team. Check. So when that situation occurred, our players were kind of like laughing about it on the sideline because it came to life. We talked about defensively, our defensive line had to generate 4 holding penalties. We generated 3. So when you just look at all the different things, we talked about explosive plays. They really executed the game plan. And then the end of the game, what it meant to our seniors and to be able to stand on that podium and accept that trophy and then having all of our fans on the field, having our band on the field. And then
I love that you thanked the band too. Oh. We talked about that on the podcast afterward, but I thought that was just something you don't see very often from a head coach to get up there. You thank the seniors, you gave them credit, you thank the fans that made the trip the day after Christmas, but you thank the band too. And they were phenomenal.
Phenomenal. And, you know, that's one family coming together and to be up there on the stage and everybody sing the fight song. And those are the things, like I spoke about post-game, that you can't get on TV. You can't get those memories. And that meant so much to our seniors and really our community. It's really amazing, too, is, you know, seeing this new team come in, but the returning players, the confidence that they have, the pride in which they have it, and really our graduating seniors, too. Now they'll have a bowl championship ring, all those things that go along with creating those great memories.
To your point, playing your best at the end, because a lot of times they'll talk about sometimes those bowl games come down to what team just wants to be there the most. That wasn't the case here. Bowling Green didn't mail it in. They had dudes that already committed to other places come play that game. So you had to go play your best game at the end to win the bowl game. I think it's really neat that your team did that.
Well, it was. You know, we had great leadership, but it was also great for our younger players. And we had a number of incoming freshmen that are here now as early enrollees. They were actually able to practice throughout the course of bowl practice and then be on the sideline for that game. So when you talk about, you know, building your foundation and continuing to build your culture, make no mistake about it, we weren't the most talented football team all year. By analytics-wise, we were supposed to win 5 games, and we won 8 games. And I always judge kind of a season. Do you overachieve? Do you underachieve? And this football team overachieved, and we won again with connection, culture, and kind of a mindset and a toughness about us.
It was a good performance for 60 minutes, but you just started the game so well. You had a great drive to open up the game. You got a field goal to cap that off, and then you get a 3-and-out, then the punt return. So you're up 10-0 5 minutes in. You never trailed in the game. And probably my favorite part of the game itself was just the way you finished it. Because in the fourth quarter, that's what you built this team for, to wear teams down. And your offensive line did exactly that. And Zach Wallace was phenomenal in that fourth quarter. He had some huge runs. And
great way to go out.
Just a great way to do it. And I thought, when you look at the program 2 years before, and I know it was the emphasis going into the following offseason because you let in 8 of those games in the fourth quarter, ended up winning 3. It's completely different now. You look at what your team did this year, 7-0 in games decided by 7 points or less, and it's the way you've built this team now.
And unfortunately, but fortunately, we had to go through that in that season that you just spoke about. We had to go through kind of those trials and tribulations of learning how to win in the fourth quarter. And we always talk about toughness and the ability to run the ball in the fourth quarter. And how do you define toughness in the fourth quarter? First of all, you have to possess the football. But second of all, it's the runs that went for 2 and 3 and 4 yard gains in the first 3 quarters now go for 10, 12, 14, 18 yards in the fourth quarter. And that's what really happened. So when you really look at the evolution of our program, it was really on full display in that game from special teams, you know, the ability to play complementary football, the ability to handle adversity. You know, you just spoke about it. Really, we've talked about it throughout the entire course of the season. Football is a game of momentum, and we never really gave up the momentum. And then we learned some things to get better, too. So, you know, the fake punt. You know, we were in punt safe. So what happens is the closer you get to the end zone when they're pooch kicking, you have what's called the cliff. And the corner will pull off at the 20-yard line because you don't want to get hit with a sky kick. But our corner pulled off at the 30. But I razzed Coach Loeffler about this. They changed the number of their third-string quarterback.
They did.
So they made it look like their punter's number with the 16 to an 18, and they ran him in. So we have to do a better job of pregame warmups in terms of the numbers of the quarterbacks and all those things associated with that. We knew it was their fake punt formation, but they changed numbers on us. So that's one thing that we'll that we'll be coaching in our mock games and moving forward.
They did try the fake punt again in the second half, and this time it was with their usual punter. So this time you were able to get the stop.
Yeah, it was a read where they were reading the defensive end. Again, we were in punt safe because we were anticipating a fake punt at that point in time, and our defensive end did not set the edge, but we did a good job of railing, was able to get the ball down. And again, that's the way you continue to hold on to the momentum. A lot of times how you keep momentum in a game is through your play on special teams. And I thought that we were able to win the special teams battle, take away the long kickoff return that they had at the end of the game. Other than that play, I thought we really controlled special teams.
At the end of the regular season, we did the look, and you know, there were three teams in the country that had improved the win total three straight seasons. Maybe a fourth got added in the bowl. By the way, Bowling Green losing kept them off that list. But when you hit stat 2, 3, 6, 8 and a bowl win, what's that number mean to you that you guys did something that time, you know, only three programs in the country had pulled off?
Well, really, really proud of our players and our entire organization of really buying into our principles, our values, how we're going to do things in moving forward, and just the culture, the connection that we built, the mindset of the pride of what it is to play football at Arkansas State University, the pride in the community in knowing what we've accomplished, starting to get out there, the long journey that we had, and to be able to go 2, 3, 6, 8. It was hard those 2 years. Those two wins, those three wins, but we knew that it was going to set up for something greater. Now, the world that we're in, how can you recreate it? How can you continue to improve with the transfer portal and new players coming in and a brand new football team? But I told our staff this in the staff meeting today, our culture already set in. We had a defensive team meeting yesterday, and one of our newcomers had a stocking cap on in the defensive team meeting. And before any of the coaches got to him, Ethan Hassler went up to him and asked him to take his hat off. I sit back and I watch all those things at an early infancy stage of building this football team. And I said, our culture is still intact and it's still winning. And when you have older players like that, that really take pride, they set the culture, and you have to fight for your culture every day. And what I've seen with the newcomers, we have 30 individuals in our football program at mid-year. They're trying to buy into it. They're trying to do everything to please us, which is great to see and moving forward.
This gets a little bit maybe wider view than we were going to get so fast, but there's a segue there, because I think part of the reason so few teams have done that is that what you see when you start looking year to year, you'll see people, hey, somebody might go from 4 to 10, but then they go back to 5 because rosters are just flipping so wildly. You were really open and honest about trying to build this thing through, you know, the foundation being high school recruiting at a time and in an era where that was a really scary proposition because of how fast rosters turn. You see that paying off, but as this era continues to evolve, have you maybe had to kind of tweak your thinking on that?
Well, you tweak it a little bit, but you still got to remember that you need a foundation. After our first year, and that's when the portal was starting to become relevant, we've been known as developing programs, and I think that you need a foundation, and we didn't have a foundation, as we all know. So we were able to say we're going to do it the way we do it, build it with high school recruiting. We've started to have the number one recruiting classes, put an emphasis, kind of supplement it through the portal. Make sure you get the right portal individuals. To me, that's the most important thing, whether it's a high school player or a portal player. Do they love football? You know, do they love the recruiting piece, or do they truly love football? Are they tough? Are they mentally tough? All those things that go into what's their character like? What's their competitive character like? And you have to be willing to walk away from an individual if they don't fit your profile. So if you really look at it, we didn't care what people said. We were going to build it the right way. And I think that's the thing. You can't put a price tag on experience. We have built three other programs kind of in very similar situations. Each program's different, but a lot of similarities. We have done that. So we didn't care what people said about us. We believe in how we do it. And so we were able to do that. And I think when you look at the 2, the 3, the 6, the 8, winning a bowl championship, contending for a conference championship, finishing tied for second for 2 years in a row, and I think we were picked 5th or 6th when the season started, this football program and this football team has overachieved. There's a lot of things that we can do better. There's a lot of things for improvement, but there's a lot of things that we have done, too, to be extremely proud of.
I was so happy for those guys that helped build that culture. Oh, Justin, yes. Parks, Char Willikas are two of those names that immediately come to mind. But for them to have the kind of games that they did in that bowl game, such a great way to go out. And I know there's so many seniors that you can add to that list, but those two in particular, for them to even receive the recognition they did after the game. Justin was named the defensive MVP, and then Char was named to the AP All-Bowl team for what he did in that game. So happy for them.
Well, exactly right. Then when you look at Trey Thomas, you look at Courtney Jackson.
Oh, yeah.
You look at Makai Butler. You look at Jacob Bear. You look at all these individuals, and I tell you, it was a strange feeling for me this past Sunday when we had our team meeting to welcome back this new team. And I'm used to seeing those individuals when you walk in that team meeting and they weren't there. And it's exciting because it's new opportunities for other individuals. But these guys are all texting me wishing that they were in the team meeting. You know, when you talk about building the future, your former players have so much to do with the positive energy, the outlook surrounding the program. You know, you look at individuals like Jeff Foreman, who's with the Vegas Raiders, and he's been FaceTiming me and so proud of what they've been able to do. The nucleus, James Blackman's been very outspoken with this football program and his buy-in still to this day. And then you look at those individuals, you know, those individuals are going to be Red Wolves for life. They're going to be part of our former player network that when they come back, and I spoke to them, you're going to be bonded by this bowl championship ring. You're going to be bonded by the experience that you've had. And when you're a former athlete, a former student athlete, all those things mean everything. And then to have the peace of mind like the Justin Parks and the Char Willikas is that we're here from ground zero. Even Malik Stryker, you guys know what Malik went through the first 2 years, and our players didn't like him because he was different in the locker room and he was trying to set our culture. And now, you know, he leaves and he still bleeds his football program every day. But the things that Justin and a Malik Stryker and all those individuals went through the first 2 years, and then how far Jeff Foreman came. You look at Corey Rucker coming back for another year and everything he's been through. It's really been a remarkable journey.
I do want to talk about Corey. He had a big performance in the bowl game, went over 100 yards, had a couple of touchdown catches, and he posted on social media a couple of days later that he was coming back for his final season. Some news that made a whole lot of people happy. I know you're right there at the top of that list.
Well, you're speaking to probably the person who was the most happiest, myself and Jalen Rayner. But I can't say enough about him, and he's really been instrumental in the recruitment. We have more Mississippi players in this recruiting class, whether Porter or high school, than I've ever been a part of. And I think Corey has been an instrumental part of that in terms of hosting, teaching them Arkansas State. So he's been a big component of that. But to have his skill set back, he's already been on a mission the way he's been training, you know, the way he's been mentoring a lot of the newcomers at the receiver position. So as much as he's a good player, I think he's really, really improved from a leadership standpoint.
Get huge savings now at every Cavanaugh dealership. Cavanaugh has a great selection of late model, low mileage, certified pre-owned cars, trucks, and SUVs. And most are still under factory warranty. We have every make and every model, so you're sure to find the vehicle you want. And when you buy at Cavanaugh, every new and used purchase comes with 1 year of free maintenance. Plus, we buy cars.
Bring a vehicle,
get a check. Come see us today at one of our dealerships or go to CavanaughCars.com.
This is Coach Butch Jones, and we need you to help our A-State athletic programs by donating to the Impact Club. This is an organization that is making a real difference in the lives of our student-athletes. Make a monthly commitment and get access to team newsletters, special gear, and exclusive access that you will not find anywhere else. Find out more and give today at ImpactClub.com. That's Impact spelled I-M-P-A-C-K-T-Club.com. Your support is greatly appreciated and is helping our programs right now. Wolves up.
Continuing to visit with A-State head coach Butch Jones. This episode presented by Cavanaugh Auto Group and by First National Bank, where they put you first always. Let's talk about this roster. Since the start of December, you've added a little over 40 players to the roster. You had 25 on the early signing day, that first Wednesday of December, 23 high school, a couple of junior college guys, 16 through the portal. Is that math correct?
We're up to 19.
Up to 19 now.
And close to 20. One last birthday present. And I will say this before we even start. The foundation of this class, make no mistake about it, a lot of the power from the coaches has been taken away. And it's been into the fan bases and what they call the collectives. Mm-hmm. And before I think we can even start talking about this recruiting class, we need to talk about the Impact Club and Dustin Kellums and Davey Carter and Chuck Mitchell and everyone, all their efforts. And I think that's the thing I've really tried to embark and impress upon our fan bases is don't misconstrue your activity on the message boards as being committed to the program. I appreciate that, good and bad. But your commitment is whatever you can do to help us through the Impact Club, and then we get into revenue sharing. And really, it comes down to a lot of times the programs that have the most resources, whether it's the retention of your players. Corey Rucker could have went anywhere in the country, and I'm talking about high-end six figures. And he chose to come back for very, very minimal. And I think when you look at that, that's part of our culture, but that doesn't happen very often. And I think as fan bases continue to grow and understand the age of that we're in, as a coach, sometimes you're helpless. So your negativity does not bring anything. I used to work for an AD that said, give me your dime, not your 2 cents. And that sounds kind of harsh, but that's kind of the reality of the world of college football that we're in. So it's actually taken a lot of the power of building relationships and outworking people in recruiting because of the age that we're in. And that's not me being negative. That's just a fact check that every head coach talks about now, that the importance of the collective for us, the Impact Club, and we would not be able to do what we're doing. These 8 wins, everyone that's a member of the Impact Club and that has given so much of themselves, whether it's their time, monetary value, the tailgates, Alpha Pack, all those things, that goes hand in hand. So they have as much to say in an impact in what's going on than the coaches and the players as well. So thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
All right. So I know we were talking about the class and the staff, but like, again, you've segued into something. I've waited a long time to get you back on this podcast. I'm going to ask this question two ways. Because of the stuff you're just talking about, and you kind of describe it as the power being taken away from the coaches. So the first way I'm going to ask this is this. If a young coach comes up to you and says, Coach, I want one of these 130 jobs you have. I want to run my own program. What skill set are you going to tell that coach he needs that you didn't need when you broke in?
That is a great question, and I know you've been sitting on that because you've never asked me that before, but I actually had to talk to a lot of young coaches on a Zoom meeting. I've always viewed my role as a CEO, but it's even so more the ability to relate, understand what's going on, the ability to manage a roster, not just in terms of numbers at each position, but from a dollar standpoint, a salary cap. That's why you see a lot of individuals hiring former NFL GMs to manage kind of the salary cap and all that. But I think the skill set of a head coach now has probably grown significantly. It's not just about football. It's not just about scheme. I lectured, you know, a lot of people think you go through a hierarchy where you're an assistant, then you're a coordinator. Well, the natural progression is being a head coach. That is the furthest thing from it. You know, sometimes as coordinators, you sit in the dark, you watch video, you come up with great schemes, but it's the ability to relate to an entire football team. It's the ability to motivate. It's the ability to close in recruiting. It's the ability to fundraise. It's the ability to do all the things in terms of managing your roster from a dollar standpoint. How do you create the connection in the culture when selfishness and greed can set in the locker room? And we've kind of seen that all over the country. So I think the skill set of a head coach is so much different, because I think there is so much in terms of the vastness or the vast qualities that you have to possess. Football has become a very, very, very small part of that.
Thus, you've had friends get out of the business, retire.
Lots of them, yeah.
We saw two head coaches in this league go be position coaches. Does that speak to kind of the
Absolutely.
Evolution of the job?
I do. You know, I'm on a lot of committees and speak to a lot of head coaches on a daily basis, and it is mentally draining. You know, it wears you out because there's so many things that go into it, from your current team to the recruitment. You get wore out mentally of the constant ask, some of the selfishness. And that's why we've kind of scaled back and gone old school again. And that's why we've won with the connection, being very transparent, building that trust and that honesty that goes into it. I think having the relationships with your players and the parents and everything that goes into it. But it gets back to the first question you asked about the skill set of a head coach now. I think also you have to try to keep the main thing, but the main thing has grown. It's not just football and managing your team. It's all those elements. Now, the other element that comes in that we haven't spoken about, that's part of the revenue share that begins in July or August, is the 105. Now, being able to manage your roster of only having 105, we have 130. And when you take those 25 individuals off your roster in terms of football, that is monumental, because you got to look at how many kickers you're going to keep, how many punters you're going to keep, how many long snappers, specialists, the ability to practice everyone. You know, like Coach Saban at Alabama invented the two spot, where you'd have two practices going on at the same time. Well, when you have 105 roster limit, you're not able to do that. So how do you manage your injuries? You know, now all of a sudden the development of your players in the strength and conditioning area, the soft tissue injuries, the nutrition that, you know, we spoke before doing the podcast that we got to improve significantly here at A-State. All those things go into it when your roster limitations shrink. The ability now of walk-ons is very minimal now. So the ability to develop walk-ons that we've had that have made significant contributions. You look at all of our specialists, they were all walk-ons. Kloon Van Andel, walk-on. You know, you look at Dominic Zavada, he was a walk-on. Kind of those days are over with because of the roster limitations.
Fascinating, just everything that's going on in the world of college football, and so much has happened over these last couple of years, and just kind of hearing you talk about your relationships and all your connections in the world of college football. When you and I are talking, you reference a lot just kind of the conversations that you have with other head coaches, other people in the college football world. It's important for you to have that dialogue, because whatever you're going through here, people are going through the same thing at other places around the world of college football, and you're all kind of navigating these new waters together. It's got to be therapeutic to some degree to talk to these other coaches and see that maybe they're dealing with a worse situation than what you're having to go through.
Well, a lot of times I say that if these are the problems that we have at A-State, we have no problems. You know, our problems are very minimal in terms of our team, all that. Now, as we continue to grow the collective and we continue to grow revenue share, that's going to be a point of contention and moving forward. But we have a great infrastructure. I tell you, our chancellor, Dr. Todd Shields, is outstanding. You know, he's been leading the way with revenue share and having a vision for what's coming. But what happens as a head coach, and you become a head coach, and these are some of the things that I've spoken to a lot of the young head coaches that have become head coaches for the first time, your inner circle shrinks. It becomes very, very small. So really, you know, as much as I talk to other head coaches, I also talk to, like, Rick Barnes is an extremely close friend of mine. I still get a text message from him every single morning. Eric Spoelstra, people like that, that, you know, it may not be the same sport, but they're going through the same things. And then you have some individuals that you're very close with in the coaching ranks. And you're right, we're all going through the same battles. So, you know, that was therapeutic of being at Alabama, is a lot of the things that Coach Saban went, you know, you're feeling the same thing. So you're like, okay, I don't feel so bad because he's going through the same things. And Lloyd Carr used to always tell me this. He said, the greatest leaders tell their pillows their worst fears. And a lot of times, you know, you get up and you go to sleep with the things on your mind, and then you wake up with them. And so it kind of drives you to go to work, and you walk into a staff meeting, and the whole staff gets unloaded on because these thoughts have kind of permeated throughout the course of your mind that entire night. But we are going through the same things, and I think you have to understand that. But then how can you create a competitive advantage? I think the word innovation in our industry is probably more vital than it's ever been, whether it's how you're marketing and branding your program, creative ways to fundraise, whether it's for the collective or the upcoming revenue share. All those things is how can you continue to take the certain circumstances that you're dealt with, but kind of turn it into a positive and create a competitive advantage for that.
All right, let's circle back to the roster, because we talk about all the new additions, and if we're doing the math right, we're talking about 44, 45 new players. So just overall, how do you feel about where this roster is at going into the spring?
Well, very optimistic, but we'll know a little bit more as we continue to actually go in phase one of our strength and conditioning program and then into phase two, which will be spring football. But so far, being about 4 days into it, I like this group. They're around us a lot. They're in. I think the new coaches have brought a new level of intensity and energy. Obviously, change can be challenging, but change can also be very, very good and uplifting. And I think we're witnessing that. But I think, you know, with the influx of new players, I spoke with Jeff Jones about this, is we can't assume anything. We can't assume our culture. We can't assume that they know how to train. So actually, we're starting from ground zero with everything. This is actually my favorite time of year. If you said, Butch, tell me what your favorite months of a 12-month calendar are, I would probably tell you right when recruiting ends, I would say February and March. Those are my two favorite months because you're developing a new football team. And so the way I approach it is every year I get a new job. This is a new job because the team that you coached last year is gone. It's passed. So you have new faces, new opportunities. Like I told our football team, everybody's at ground zero. It's new opportunities for playing time. It's new opportunities for leadership. And then for a lot of these individuals, it's a new opportunity for their personal brand and their reputation because these new coaches have no stereotypes. They have no stigmas. They don't know anyone. So you kind of get a chance to kind of...
They feel like they got a fresh start.
No question. You know, you have to continue to elevate who you are. You have to recreate yourself every single year. And it starts with me. How am I different? I can't be the same coach I was last year. And I challenge our entire coaching staff. How are you different? You can't be the same version of yourself. How are you better? What have you learned? And we've had, you know, a lot of staff conversations where each coach has kind of spoke about how they're a better version of themselves, where our players have that same opportunity. And it's like I told our staff, we expect our players to be better. Well, it starts with us. We have to be better as well.
When you were talking about taking it down to ground zero, what it brought to mind was how many old UCLA basketball players you heard talk about the crazy amount of time Jordan Wood would talk with them about putting on socks and shoes because how important your feet are. And he said he'd spent the whole practice early in the preseason and that all he would talk about, the right way to put on your socks.
Well, it gets back to when we started this podcast about Ethan Hassler and telling a newcomer to take his hat off. It's when we show up in the weight room and everyone has their shirts tucked in. Is having your shirts tucked in, is that going to help you win a game? maybe not, but it's those small things that nobody sees that adds up to the big things that everyone wants. You know, it's from jumping off sides, it's the pre-snap penalties, it's the emotional penalties, it's just doing the right things. And so that's what we've really honed in on. On Monday, we'll have our limp draft, so we'll split our team up into 10 groups. These individuals are vying for leadership opportunities, and then it's a way to expose our team again of kind of recreating themselves in the three areas that we will compete on a daily basis in the academic world, in the self-development world with community service, and then in the weight room and the football standpoint, and we'll compete on a daily basis.
There are things, you know, you've said since you've been here, you're on the outside listening, that's going to fall in the category of coach speak. But having seen it from my vantage point, like, I don't know if anybody else, but let me tell you the things you've made me a believer in. When they hear about, you know, everybody trust the process and how it ties into the other thing I've heard you talk about is, you know, play into a standard instead of the scoreboard, with the exception of, you know, late into the game situation. Again, that sounds cliche-ish, but when you strip it down, you're teaching these guys that if you're the team that does the most things right the most often, you don't have to worry about what the score is, because at the end of the game, it will have taken care of itself.
The team that makes the fewest mistakes will win, and that was Maxim 1 by General Nealon. And that stuck with me, and Bill Belichick says it this way: before you can win the game, you have to first not lose the game. And that's when I talk about understanding what winning football looks like. And in that bowl game, winning football kind of came to fruition, all these examples that go into that. So, you know, how do you not lose the game first? It's doing the little things right. And the little things start with your off the field habits. And then if you win off the field, you're going to win on the field. It's going to class every single day. It's knowing where to sit. It's being on time to your meetings, being on time to study hall, being a great role model in the community. You don't win by chance and by circumstance. And all those things add up over time. And if you don't do those things, it don't get you till it gets you. And it usually gets you in critical moments, critical stages of the game. And that's not coach speak. You think about it.
No, no, it's not. It's really not.
If you're a manager or you're a factory worker and you're working on the assembly line, and we talk about the standard never changes.
Yeah.
Okay. So it doesn't matter what time of day it is, the output that you have and the way you assemble your product, it doesn't change if you got 10 minutes left in the shift or you got 5 hours left in the shift. The expectations don't change, and it's the same thing we approach our football program.
I know you're excited about these new coaches, so let's talk about the defensive side of the ball. You've got all new coaches on defense now, and your new defensive coordinator is a guy by the name of Nate Dreiling. Tell us why he was the right fit to lead your defense.
Well, I think, first of all, just like anything, it's always a ongoing total assessment throughout the course of the season. And then when I had some time after the ODU game, did a total assessment of every component of what we do here, but not also what we do here, but in the manner with which we do it. And as we all know, moving forward happens pretty quickly. So just, you know, when I did a total assessment and how can we continue to grow and elevate, I felt that we needed some changes, and change is hard. And I think people don't understand there's personal relationships involved. You know, there's families involved that, you know, we become great friends off the field. Our wives are very connected. So it's the hardest thing to do from a leadership standpoint, because there's a lot of personal relationships and respect along the way. But at the end of the day, as the caretaker of Arkansas State football, I have to first and foremost do what I feel is best for our organization. So we made some changes, and you just mentioned defensive coordinator. You know, I always look at what individuals do more with less. And you really kind of look at his journey from Pittsburgh State, small level football that's been successful. I was always a fan of what they did at New Mexico State and what he did from the previous year when he showed up statistical wise, and then that first year, and really watching the growth and evolution of that football program under Jerry Kill. But Nate was a defensive coordinator. And then I think thrown into a really difficult situation of navigating the circumstances that happened at Utah State and being a head football coach for about 5 months, what he was able to do there, and not only being the head coach there, but the defensive coordinator, and then talking to a lot of individuals around the country and kind of the way we want to play football here and play defensive football here. All the roads kind of led to him, and I spoke to a number of individuals, but he's from Kansas City. His father's a head coach in the Kansas City area, so he grew up a coach's son. Recruiting ties to where we want to recruit more in terms of the Oklahomas, the Kansas Cities, move kind of more Midwest, West, and kind of venture in those areas as well. But just, I think his style of play, his visions kind of will parallel align to our program principles and values, how we want to play. So it kind of become a no-brainer the more time that we spoke.
It's emotional for you as a coach to go through this, but at the same time, you're looking for the overall health of your football program and just the value of a fresh voice from time to time. You really didn't have much changeover in your coaching staff for several years, but to bring in a fresh voice, just that in itself, I know, has a lot of value.
Well, I think change can be really positive, and I learned that through my time at Alabama. It's like if you look at a bell curve, you're trying to jump the bell curve because you don't want to go on the downward slope. So you try to jump the bell curve all the time. And I think, you know, you have a fresh start for a lot of individuals. You have new ideas. Obviously, your core values are not going to change, but maybe a different perspective. And then you get people that are really energized and excited to be here. Nate Dreiling has been here for a very short period of time, and he's already closed on a house, and they're actually moving in it today.
Oh, wow.
So when you really look at the excitement, and I think people appreciative of this place and the opportunity that's been presented to them. And again, I'm very, very complimentary. I'm very, very blessed. I'm very, very appreciative. I think that's the best word of the previous coaches, but we got to continue to grow. And so I'm excited about the entire staff. And again, it's kind of elevated. It's new, fresh ideas from a recruiting standpoint, from a development standpoint, from a fundamental standpoint. I think that's the thing that has probably impressed me the most with this new coaching staff is their attention to detail with the fundamentals and details. We're not putting any scheme in for the first 3 weeks. It's all fundamentals and details. It's in the how of how we're going to do things. And I think that's really good, particularly when you mention having over 40 newcomers in your football program and starting from ground zero.
So when he gets in, sort of talk us through the composition of the rest of the staff, not just sort of who you brought in, but kind of, I guess, a combination of either player or coaches he had connections to, maybe some you did, or in some cases, maybe neither one.
Yeah, I think it was really important to kind of arm him with individuals that he truly trusted, individuals that have been in his system. Also, those individuals had to meet our principles and values of good people and good teachers, good recruiters. You know, when you look at it, there's five things that a college football coach has to do, and this is how I evaluate everyone on our staff. And this is why it's extremely difficult to coach at the college ranks. The five things they have to do is they have to be able to scheme. They have to be able to teach the fundamentals and details of the position. They have to be able to recruit. They have to be able to evaluate in the recruiting process. And one of the biggest things now is they have to be able to mentor our group of young men. And so I look at those five things when we're hiring a staff, and I wanted to make sure that those individuals that we hired met that five criteria, and they did. The trust that they have amongst the defensive staff, the connection, it's already, again, our players see it. But, you know, an individual like Griff McCarley, who is our linebacker coach that came to us last year from Ole Miss, he's able to kind of have a reborn mentality, but he's going to bring a lot to the table. But when you look at not only Nate, but we hired Jalen Ortiz, who is our corners coach. You know, he coached recently at Nevada. They were at Utah State together. They were at Oregon together. So they understand from Mario Cristobal what it is to recruit at a high level. I've known Mario for a long period of time. And I know in order to be on his staff, you have to be able to recruit and you have to be able to evaluate. Then the safeties coach is Kwame Adjeman, who again was at Nevada, was at Utah State for a brief time, was also at the University of Oregon. So all these individuals,
played there.
Yep. And then you look at Rashad Pittman and what he was able to do at a junior college level and the players that he developed. And that's going to lead us to inroads in recruiting the JUCOs in the state of Mississippi. And then make no mistake about it, also changes on the special teams. We finished number one in the Sun Belt Conference in the four composite of special teams now for 3 years in a row. Dakota Tillman has had an instrumental part of the special teams. And so what he's done from a recruiting standpoint, from a development standpoint, and he's part of that youth and that energy and that drive. So to be able to have him be the special teams coordinator, I'm excited about. You talked about change. I think we all saw kind of the progression of our offensive line in the bowl game. You know, Nick Grimes is a completely different personality than Coach Kwan. Coach Kwan did a tremendous job, and I'm excited for his next journey at UCLA. But I think that change kind of helped those players. And, you know, every coach has a different way of doing it. So I think Nick Grimes, you know, you look at Alex Jones and some of the things that he'll bring to the tight end position. He's already worked with them, but some different things that he'll bring in the Alabama experiences. So when you really look at it, then, you know, involved now in kind of restructuring our recruiting department and the ability to add a general manager. And I want somebody that has been there, done that, has kind of been at different levels and run different programs. So again, this is a great offseason to continue to grow and elevate our entire program.
A big endorsement, quite honestly, for Dakota Tillman, that you would elevate him to that spot. And because the special teams coordinators have changed, the personnel has changed, the end result has not. That's because special teams are the head coach's baby. So if you trust him with your baby, that says quite a lot.
It does. And, you know, whatever you make important is going to be important. Whatever you emphasize is going to be important. And obviously special teams. And, you know, we talked about the analytics of the prediction of us winning five games and we won eight games. Well, if you go back and you look at special teams, you know, we were searching for those three games. So go back, Tulsa game, big punt return, helped us win the football game. You know, when you look at the bowl game, big punt return, it helped us win the football game on the road at Georgia State.
Yeah, that was
big
huge
punt return. You know, and also the vertical field position with our punt team and our kick placements, our kickoff team. We were second in the country going in the last game of the year, but we were ranked second in the country in terms of our kickoff. You look at our specialists and their production, where they were coached by Dakota Tillman and recruited by Dakota Tillman. Dakota understands the expectations. He understands how we do things, but above all else, he is a student of the game. He is eager and he is wanting. I always say I'd rather say whoa than sick him. And I've had to kind of say whoa a little bit. But you would rather have that as a coach.
We had a blocked field goal in that bowl game,
yep,
too.
And you know what the crazy thing is? On that night that we practiced, Marcus Bradley, who blocked that kick, blocked it at the end of practice.
Is that right?
The same scenario. And when he did it, he was so excited and he came to me and said, Coach, I did it in practice. That's where it started. And I think the little things that maybe people don't see is the discipline in the details of what happened after the blocked punt. And it was blocked.
Got away from it.
Behind, you know, on our side of the ball. And you saw our team do a poison call and get away from it. We had practiced that over and over and over. And we made it came to life in a critical situation.
It's good to have momentum going into the offseason. But it seems like there's just a lot of good stuff going on. The schedule's complete now. We know everybody we're playing. It came out last week. The Eastern Division opponents, we're going to App. Georgia Southern's coming here, but it'll be here before you know it. And we've talked about it here. I mean, to have three straight games inside the state of Arkansas to begin the season is pretty special.
It is, and I know everyone's looking forward to that trip to Little Rock. You know, I think that game is so healthy and so great to the entire state of Arkansas. And I'm going to continue to say, I don't know why in this landscape of college football where non-conference scheduling is big, why would we not play every single year when you really look at it, when you look at the economic impact that it'll make for Little Rock, mm-hmm. the economic impact for everyone involved. I don't know why when we're going out and we're, no offense, but we're having to go on the road at Michigan, or we're having to go on the road at Iowa State, or on the road against Ohio State, or bring Iowa State into Jonesboro. Why would we not make this where it's an every year occurrence? Because I think it's healthy for this great state. It's great for high school football. It's a win-win for everyone. And you talk about promoting our game when there's so many challenges that are surrounding our game right now. I think it's extremely healthy for both parties, and looking forward to it. And obviously a chance to play an SEC opponent that is a bowl champion themselves and have a lot of respect for their program. And we'll talk more. That's obviously way down the line. We got to focus on finding out what our identity is and building our identity with this football team and really kind of seeing and then gauging, you know, don't forget now we have one more portal window. Which is really remarkable of one more portal window. And I know that's an area that the coaches are trying to eliminate right now.
Yeah, they're trying to cut it down to one, right?
We need a commissioner of college football. And I think if we could ever get to where we have a commissioner of college football and really get a lot of things with the calendar and everything wrapped around, and no better than a guy that we call NLS, the guy in the straw hat, Coach Nick Saban. I think he would be remarkable in that role. Now, I don't know if he would do it, but if he would do it, look at what he's done for college football just on ESPN and College Game Day and the insight that he brings.
Yeah.
And it's funny. It's kind of fun for me because I sit there, and when he talks, it's like sitting in a staff meeting.
You know what he's going to say.
I know what he's saying before he says it. I can finish the words. I've heard him about 15 times. But when you really look at his outlook and how he approaches things and how he kind of expands upon things, you talk about the greatest ambassador for the game of football and college football, there's none other than Coach Saban.
He doesn't strike me as – and you can certainly speak to what this might mean to him, because like I was joking with Jeff Pierent the other day, you know, they sprung on him that, you know, no-brainer, he's going into the Hall of Fame at the end of the year. And Jeff's take was like, yeah, he's mostly going to be pissed he has to sit through the ceremony.
You know what? I've seen a different side to him. I think deep down inside, he's really looking forward to that.
Yeah, that's
you
a
know,
big
and
deal.
I think he's extremely appreciative, and he says it all the time of all the people that have helped him get there. But to his credit, you look at all the people that he's changed their lives or elevated their lives, not only from a football coaching standpoint, but from a personal side. And they always say your life is indicative of the people that you influence on a positive basis. And you really look at all the people that he has impacted, and not just from a football standpoint, but charity and Nick's kids, and you look at the communities and what he's done for the communities. You look at, you know, for administrators and everything that he's put his stamp on is pretty remarkable. And I will tell you this, when he goes to that ceremony, I think that meant the world to him. I know his facial expressions. I know where he was, and I know he was surprised, but also I think he was very appreciative and very prideful that that moment happened.
Pretty easy call.
Yeah, we knew it was coming. Yeah, you could tell he was genuinely appreciative of that. And we're genuinely appreciative of you and everything you're doing. And just
this has been kind of pure therapy for me.
Yeah.
You look at everything we've spoke about. We've kind of got caught up in over a month and a half in a very short period of time. So I always appreciate doing this. And I think it's important that our fans really recognize what's going on and all the positive things.
Yeah.
And, you know, we talk about football being a game of momentum, all the positive momentum. And, you know, you look at even fan attendance being up over like 50 some odd percent over the last couple years. You look at the Alpha Pack, you look at the Red Wolf Walks, you look at all that. Now, you know, as we continue to elevate our program, I need to challenge our fans. We need to come out at the end of the season.
Right.
That's unacceptable. It is what it is, you know, so we have to continue to understand the importance as we continue to kind of elevate our football program. But overall, our fan attendance, our fan support, the positive energy that they bring, they're as big of the momentum that we have right now as anyone. And I will tell you this, I think you guys know me by now. There isn't anyone who takes more pride in being the head football coach here than Butch Jones. I understand the role. I understand the importance with the university community. But the pride that I take in how far we've come, but also continuing to set the standards and the bar at a very, very high level. We're just beginning. That's kind of the mindset. So I'm just appreciative of all the fans here and everything. Excited for Andrew Jones. He's yet committed, but I think he's close to making a commitment. So
all right.
Trying to work on
keep
that
working
well.
On it.
Well, I was going to ask.
Work on the mom still, I'm sure.
No question. You know, she wants to make sure everything is right from growth and development of her youngest. So we're still recruiting.
You know, Matt made the comment on the podcast, I think when we sat down last week, that you'd come up to him in Mobile and said, hey, we got to do the podcast soon. And I said, well, that worked for us. I think he's maybe wanting to come back. Maybe he thinks there's some stuff he needs to offer a rebuttal from what the boys said when they were in here a few weeks ago. But they did a great job.
They did. And I appreciate y'all having them on. And I know that meant a lot to them, too. And we actually sat as a family. And we kind of evaluated them on the podcast. So that was a great family time. What do you guys do in your free time? Well, we listen to Second to None podcast and we evaluate everyone.
I love it.
I'm nervous now to get our grades when this thing ends here in a second.
Well, I can tell you this, Dad, it will be thoroughly evaluated when I get home, probably, you know, when this airs. So hopefully it's okay and it meets their approval.
It was fantastic. Thanks for coming in on your birthday. Happy birthday. And thanks for all you do.
Well, you guys are the best. And again, for all you do. And Matt, you're very special to me in our relationship. And you've seen it all from ground zero, from the workouts when we first got here to the summer workouts to, you know, the bowl prep. And I think if there's anyone who's kind of seen the, how do I want to say, the total evolvement or
evolution
of our football program, it's you. And, you know, the Sundays of coming in after a hard-fought victory or a hard defeat, and you're always the same person. So I thank you personally for what you do for me, but also for the entire Arkansas State community.
Well, thank you very much.
Bobo, we're still working on. So
work in progress.
First National Bank's roots run deep in Northeast Arkansas. We began a single Paragould branch with one idea, customers first. By focusing on the best products banking has to offer and valuing the highest level of service, we're now 23 branches across Arkansas and Tennessee. As First National Bank grows, our roots only get deeper, and the mission remains the same. You first, always. Learn more about our products and services at fnbank.net. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
Red Wolf fans, this is DeMario Davis, proud Red Wolf and linebacker for the New Orleans Saints. And I'm asking you to help out our current A-State student athletes by donating to the Impact Club. This organization helps our program stay competitive and supports our players by facilitating NIL agreements that allow them to endorse local charities. Make a monthly commitment and get access to team newsletters, special gear, and exclusive access you won't find anywhere else. Find out more and give today at impactclub.com. Thank you, and Wolves up.
Wrapping things up here on the Second to None podcast, presented by First National Bank and by Cavanaugh Auto Group. You can check out Cavanaugh's entire selection of new and pre-owned vehicles at cavanaughcars.com. Let's talk basketball. Huge week for the A-State men. Couple of wire-to-wire home victories. They hosted the Ragin' Cajuns on Thursday. Got off to a great start in that game, held them to 23.5% shooting in the first half, led by 20 at the half. They went on to win by 20. Look, we're never going to take those wins over the Cajuns for granted. That's been a pretty one-sided series over the years, and you know, there's a good reason for it. They've had a lot of really, really good teams, so it's always good to beat that bunch.
It is, yeah. I mean, I still think if you just polled Arkansas State fans and see who in the Sun Belt is your biggest rival, I don't think there's much doubt at this point with Little Rock gone that the answer, and it honestly, regardless of sport, I think the answer you get back is going to be that bunch. We've talked with Kobe Julian before about the feeling being somewhat mutual down there. They view Arkansas State as a rival, even though they have an in-state rival still in the conference. So, like I said, my only wish for those two schools is that they weren't 7 hours apart, because that's all – that's kind of the only component missing from this really being a, you know, full-on big-time rivalry in all the sports, is the ability for each school's fans to get to the other spot.
So the Red Wolves win that game on Thursday night, 83-63, and then – Saturday, really similar. Played great defensively right out of the gate. They held Georgia State to 24% shooting in the first half. Led by 25 at halftime. It was a first half that featured a 29-0 run. We've seen a lot of great runs over the years. I can't remember 29 unanswered points, but held Georgia State scoreless for a full 10 minutes of that first half.
And I didn't even know that. Like, you know, because, again, I see the game, but I don't watch the game.
You just saw they had 11 points for a really long time.
I just knew we were, you know, off to a fast start, and knew that we were blowing them out, honestly. It wasn't until somebody at the game texted me, it's like, is a 29-0 run a school record, before I really knew we went on a 29-0 run.
Led by as many as 36 in that game, went on to win 85-59. Great crowd, over 5,600 on hand Saturday. Our guys just continue to roll on the home floor. 9-0 this season at home. They've won 12 in a row dating back to last season at First National Bank Arena. That's the longest home win streak in 14 years. You got to go back to Coach Brady's team back in the 2010-2011 season, last time we had a win streak this long. But the Red Wolves now sitting at 14-5 overall. They're 5-2 in league play. Tied for second in the Sun Belt standings. And, of course, we got a huge game coming up on Thursday now, 8 o'clock, as Appalachian State comes in here. ESPN2 will be in town, and you're focused right now on trying to stripe the bank and get as many people packed in there as possible.
Yeah, we've had some ticket sales stuff out there really since Saturday night. We were ready to roll out some flash ticket sales on some lower-level tickets. You know, and there aren't very many of those. To begin with, there's a sale. There's still a flash sale going on, depending on when you're listening to this, on some upper level tickets, 2 for $12, like we did last year in the Troy game. So I guess now it's, you know, 2 for $12 to match that 12 game home win streak. You know, I'll be honest. Like, I see what goes on social media. I see there are people questioning whether or not we can stripe the bank, whether or not you get enough cooperation and get the messaging out and have people actually do it. I'm real confident that's going to happen. So if you haven't seen this yet, by the time you're listening to this podcast, and chances are you have, I mean, at least for the lower bowl, I'm real, real, real confident it's going to be striped, because we're putting a shirt out on every seat in the lower bowl that goes to the color you're supposed to wear. Now, go to our social media, you know, A-State Red Wolves on social media, and look around. There's a map. What color we're asking you to wear based on what section you're sitting in.
Yeah.
But we'll have the lower bowl blanketed in the appropriate colors for Thursday night.
Should look great. And can't wait to see the kind of atmosphere we'll have in there on Thursday. And anybody that remembers the way it was for that Troy game, the nationally televised game last season, remembers just how electric that atmosphere was, and hopefully we can top that. And then the homestand concludes Saturday at 2. Texas State will be in town. So
men's golf, by the way, at halftime Saturday, men's golf is getting their Sun Belt Conference championship rings.
Just another reason to come out this weekend. Women's basketball, man, they're rolling. They've won 6 in a row. Couple of home wins this past week. The overtime victory over the Cajuns on Wednesday night, 67-65. That was kind of a wild game. They were in full control in the first half, up 14 at the intermission, but got outscored 19-4 in the third quarter. So down one after three, came back, forced overtime, and Kennedy Montu with the game-winning three in the final seconds to win it.
Yeah, I obviously can speak to this game a little bit. Got up 20 with about 3 minutes to go in the first half, which is what happens when you hit 10 threes in the first half. You get up. They went 10 for 25 from the three-point line in the first half. I knew even up 20 with 3 minutes to go in the second quarter, there was no time for a victory lap.
Far from over.
Because Gary Broadhead's team, they're probably the best defense in the league. And they were going to then just play the rest of the way with sort of reckless abandon in terms of what they do on offense. They just kind of bury their head and go. So they got the last 6 points of the first half, got it to 14. And then, as you said, we're up one by the end of the quarter. Like, no part of my kind of recollection of that game is about, quote unquote, blowing a 20-point lead. I knew you needed the lead because what Lafayette wasn't going to do is panic because they hang their hat on defense and defense travels. And that's exactly what happened. They chipped away at it. And so I think what's cool, and we'll talk a little bit about it more as it gets Saturday, is that for the entire second half of that game and overtime, we basically beat them playing their own game.
Yeah.
Now, I know you got spotted the lead, but that the last 25-plus minutes of that game was played the way the Raging Cajuns wanted it played, and A-State found a way to win it anyway.
To win that game on Wednesday gives you a little bit of momentum heading into the weekend. And, man, what a first half they had against ULM on Saturday. A ULM team, they had beat in Monroe the Saturday before, in which they had to come from behind to do it. At this time, it was all Red Wolves from the start and held them to 11% shooting in the first half. ULM was 4-for-35 from the field. Red Wolves led 32-12 at the intermission, went on to win 71-43, just a dominant performance.
It was, you know, I think the 12 points, maybe they're looking to see maybe the lowest first half point performance, you know, ever against a Division I opponent, maybe in the history of the program. It's an arena record for the fewest points given up in a half to a Division I opponent. Another thing I'm going to tell you about this game Saturday I thought was neat. Early on, it's not like, you know, a lot of times this team will come out and they're just going to hit a bunch of threes early. They're going to come out firing. Like, going into last week, 49% of their shots are three-pointers. Saturday, you could see them making a concerted effort at their plans to get to the rim. Now, even though that might be get to the rim and kick to a shooter, but they were getting to the rim. On a day where three-pointers weren't falling. Like, right, they hit the first one and then didn't hit another one in the first half. I don't think missed 10 or 11 in a row after that. So that's what I think is cool is that this team right here in November – and probably all of December doesn't win either one of the games that won last week. They're going to lose them both. They're going to lose a grinded-out game against a team guarding them like the Raging Cajuns guarding them, and they're going to lose a game where they weren't hitting threes and not getting as many looks as they did against Monroe. They're going to lose both of those games a month ago or a month and a half ago.
They've come a long way.
They sure. I mean, they really have. It's pretty special to see that they just continue to evolve, and the biggest evolution of that's there. They found that they now have more than one way to win a game.
Like the men, they're in second place in the Sun Belt standings in good shape. 6-1 in league play. They're 10-7 overall.
A couple other little notes before we kind of wrap up basketball there. But in their six-game win streak, they've had five different leading scorers. Their leading rebounder Saturday was Mimi McAllister, all 5'6" of her. She had 10 rebounds. And then Saturday overall, just kind of what a dominating day it was. You know, we talked last week when the men won at Troy, came from behind. The women won at Monroe, came from behind. We mentioned that, you know, they won those two games and they led for a combined total between the two of them of 6 minutes and 48 seconds out of 80 minutes. Saturday, that number, last week it was 6 minutes and 48 seconds. This week it was 77 minutes and 58 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
Of total lead time. The other 2 minutes and 2 seconds
tied.
Were ties. Neither team ever trailed. In fact, for 60 minutes and 30 seconds of the 80 minutes played Saturday at the bank, A-State led by double figures.
Yeah, just some dominant performances for the men and the women. A lot of fun to watch. Now, we mentioned the men are home this week. The women will be on the road. They'll be in Lafayette Thursday, so trying to beat the Cajuns for the second time in a week. Thursday at 6, and then Saturday at 2, they'll be in Mobile taking on South Alabama. Tennis team, busy weekend. They beat Missouri State, hosted Missouri State for that match on Friday at the Trim Gym, won 6-1. Or 6-1, and I actually went out there with my daughter on Friday and had a big crowd out there. Kind of neat how Coach Lama tried to make sure there were a lot of people out there. He had food. I know your marketing team was represented out there. A lot of giveaways during the event. But, yeah, just a really cool time on Friday night and able to put together a dominant performance, winning 6-1. Then they went on the road Sunday and played at Ole Miss and lost 4-1. But the one win, I'm going to try to say her name here, Anna Gregoriva, she won her number one singles match. So our number one singles was able to beat the number one at Ole Miss, which I think says a lot. So tennis continues to play well, and they'll return to action coming up January 31st at St. Louis.
It's pretty neat to watch what they got going on, and Coach Sujay is sort of tireless in his efforts to not just make the product better on the court, which he certainly has, but just his effort in just pushing and promoting his own program is he's tough to keep up with. And that shows, too, like a lot of what you saw, a lot of people out there, and you're, even at these indoor places, you're standing three or four deep at the rail trying to see, but that's largely to the efforts he's put in.
Bowling was in action over the weekend. They finished third out of 38 teams that competed at the Northeast Classic in Newcastle, Delaware. A really solid performance there. They're going to be back in action coming up this weekend at the Prairie View Invitational, which will be in Arlington, Texas. And indoor track and field, want to mention them. They competed at the Vanderbilt Invitational this past weekend. Lots of career bests there. Several top five finishes. Noah Isaiah winning the men's weight throw. He had the sixth best mark in school history at the event. And Kiara Strayhorn had a long jump of 6.25 meters to finish runner-up. That was the second best mark in school history. So indoor track and field rolling along, and they're going to be in Illinois this weekend competing in the Fighting Illini Challenge. Anything else we need to talk about here? I know it's been a really long episode, but I think it's been a really good episode.
Yeah.
Thoroughly enjoyed our visit with Butch Jones.
Yeah, that was fun. Obviously, folks could tell he's in great spirits, and honestly, why wouldn't he be? Things are going well there. Enjoyed him spending part of his birthday with us.
Man, just really appreciate all he's doing. And you know, from the bowl to recruiting to, you know, the team coming in, all these new coaches that are on his staff as well. We had a lot to cover, and certainly we were able to do that with Coach Jones. So thanks to everybody for listening. As always, we appreciate you tuning in, and we hope you join us again next week for our next edition of the Second to None podcast presented by First National Bank and the Cavanaugh Auto Group.